Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday. It's May 13th, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We begin our broadcast today, this Friday, with none other than New York State Assemblyman Nader Sage. He represents Yonkers. The Assembly District is 90. The entire district is Yonkers. And I see that the assembly member is already on. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. Very good Friday to you and everyone listening. Glad to be on the show again.
Absolutely. What a thrill to have you on. I didn't realize, you know, well, it seems like every week that we speak, I'm more and more impressed by the number of issues that you take up and the number of issues that you resolve. At the assembly, and so, you know, you've been working all over the place. One of the biggest things that I always found interesting is we're going through a crisis now with a shortage of baby formula, and you're already
correct.
On top of that. There's a supply chain problem, I understand, from China. We get many of the raw materials from there. You know, the supply chain problem is in every issue, practically. Have we abrogated as a nation? Have we abrogated our responsibility to have a supply chain that works here to save a couple of bucks? And how much are we really saving by importing all this stuff from abroad? So we're dependent on them, and we don't have it.
Sure. Well, you're right. You know, we should have learned from the pandemic when it became grave and we had a tremendous shortage of, you know, medical supplies and even something as simple as face masks or even medications.
Yep.
Or, you know, we should have realized, you know, how dangerous that was for us as a nation not to be prepared. You know, and you're right. Too often we allow too much products to be exported from outside, from other nations around the world. And sometimes if it's items that are of necessity, I believe the government, whether state or federal government levels, should be more involved. They should monitor, you know, products that are really reflective or necessary for our safety. We should have a process that encourages American industries and producers. Of course, it gives us more jobs here at home. But at the same time, you know, we go back years ago, if you recall the days of Buy American. You know, I'm not saying it should be across the board, but I really think we got to be smarter as a nation. We got to be more organized. We got to start encouraging incentives for individuals and businesses to produce American-made products. For example, baby formula. I wrote along with a number of my colleagues, I've initiated, you know, even before the federal government got involved or the state to recognize it's an urgent problem, we saw that there was an urgent issue with baby formula, for example. And I initiated a strong letter, a correspondence to both the governor and to the attorney general here in New York, urgent, and I had many of my colleagues sign on to this, that they should look at price gouging. Very often, it's become such a serious problem, especially with baby formula. And, you know, unless a mother is breastfeeding her child, I mean, this is urgent. You know, this is urgent where if you lack the products, you lack, you know, you go around the supermarkets locally and mothers and families can't buy baby formula, or if they go online because people know there's a scarcity, they raise the price, they start selling expired baby formula or sometimes products that are really should be off the shelves that shouldn't be served to babies and individuals, and it's causing a serious problem. So this proposal, this strong correspondence really urges the state at this stage to really go after these individuals that are trying to utilize for business purposes and manipulate the economy in the process, where they intentionally make it their business to cause a shortage and therefore, you know, raise the price and cause this panic and then be able to sell their products at a much higher price. So the government should go after these individuals, and they should put them on notice and even punish them if necessary. But it took this type of initiative where, you know, whether it's this initiative or recently we've been talking about my legislation that's moving really well to get rid of all taxes on diapers, whether infant baby diapers or adult diapers. Again, that's something that's real. It's a necessity for the public at large. And you got to have the wisdom. You got to be able to have a broad view of your community, your state, your nation. And thankfully, you know, I've been able to acquire, you know, the appreciation to understand issues on every level. And that's why for me, it's not just focusing on Yonkers. It's in many ways focusing on statewide concerns and issues, national, international. There's a lot going on, and legislators, we gotta begin to think more of the big picture as well as the little picture. And just looking at the baby formula,
I was thinking about all these issues, and then I'm saying, well, if you reduce costs or if they're subsidized, and it seems that corporations are subsidized to import the stuff from abroad, they get a tax benefit. By buying the product at a lesser rate somewhere else, but then they charge the rate that they would normally charge here in the United States anyway. So the consumer doesn't really get that much of a break. And then when they start price gouging, it ends up costing the government much more in order to subsidize what can't be affordable for a lot of people, because it drives people into a financial bind. But then
You're right. You
pointed out too that a $100 shirt, and not everybody buys a $100 shirt. There are shirts that you can get for $500, and you can get a shirt for $10 or $15.
Or $5 sometimes.
exactly. So, but the point is, though, they don't tax the shirt. But if a woman has a shirt or a blouse, they charge tax on that. So why don't we balance even our taxation issue so that it balances out in a different way? I mean, supposedly men earn more than women, so then can't men afford to pay more for a shirt, whether it's $5 or $25 or $50 or $500? Let them pay
but
the tax.
You're right.
Why don't we balance out our coffers, our state coffers? Because
the state needs taxes,
right, to pay for education,
you know,
and everything else.
We definitely, you know, definitely in New York State, you know, we've been a little bit more creative in the last couple of years. And I'd like to say I took a role in trying to the direction a little different, you know, where in the past, anytime we needed funding, it was always tax the businesses, the property owners, the investors. And over the years, we found that many of these businesses and organizations stopped building in New York. They stopped, you know, manufacturing in New York. They started to leave the state. We started to lose taxes and a tax base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead, we started to focus on creative initiatives. You know, here in Yonkers, for example, one of the most, I think, advantage we've had as far as taxes moving forward is pushing hard for MGM to get a full gaming license. And, you know, the state issued three licenses, and I, along with many others, including the chair of the Gaming Racing Commission, Gary Pretlow, fellow assemblyman, we fought hard to make sure that MGM, that was already in place, they had a facility, you know, for many years, Empire Casino. And now, you know, the word is, because of our lobbying efforts, MGM will get a license. the amount of funding that would be generated from MGM, aside from 1,200 jobs, you know, for the local community, good paying jobs, the economic benefits are tremendous. But the taxation revenue that would support education and other statewide initiatives is really crucial. And that allows us, by generating this extra income, that allows us to put a stop, put the brakes on raising middle class property owners, homeowner taxation. So, you know, to me, that's a win-win. When you can tell residents of Yonkers and New York, look, if you own property, we're going to work really hard to make sure your taxes are not increased. We want you to stay in this locality. We don't want you to leave Yonkers and New York State. We want you to raise your families and educate them here. But this is the type of initiative where you look at taxation, you look at ways to raise revenue, you look at ways to make sure you get enough money to pay for education and healthcare and support services. Too often, we lose focus, and for too long, New York State, at every level, unfortunately, in many cases, has lost focus on where their energy, where the legislation, where the policy. For example, now we know a lot of us are frustrated with the rising cost of gas. Gas has been a big killer. You know, people that used to fill their cars for $30, $40, now it's up to $70, $80. I mean, it doubled.
Right.
And people are frustrated. They can't afford it. And New York State, we put forth legislation beginning next month. In a few weeks, June 1st, there's going to be an automatic 16-cent saving on state DAC taxes. Then this week, the county, Westchester County, said, hey, we're going to waive our taxes. So between the county and the state, my hope is on June 1st, gas prices between the county and the state should be reduced by 40 cents. Now, that would help a lot of people, reducing taxes between the county and the state by 40 cents should help us and really bring down some of the frustration with inflation, with the rising cost of energy and so forth. But having said that, we're already looking ahead and saying to the government, to the state level, and those agencies monitoring price gouging that, hey, when we give back to the public to help, whether it's state or local county taxes, right, to bring the price down, we better make sure that the gas producers and the business people in the middle don't raise it from the other end so that at the end of the day, they're benefiting, you know, and that's what I'm worried about. So I'm able to say, hey, we're putting forth a good initiative, but how do we make sure that people don't play games with it? How do we make sure that at the other end, someone goes, hey, they brought down taxes by 40 cents, so let me raise mine by 30, extra profit, and then, okay, we'll leave at 10 cents. You know, the whole goal of this was to relieve taxes by 40 cents, not 10 cents. And that's where you got to be proactive. You got to think of, you know, it's almost like playing a chess game. And whether it's on the international market or national or local, we got to be smarter as state officials, as representatives, because at the end of the day, we got to represent the best interests of New Yorkers, of people in Yonkers, our constituents, and on the national scene, too.
Absolutely. Well, that makes sense. At least you understand the complexity of the picture, and quite often, big business takes advantage of the costs that you're reducing with legislation, and they're filling the gap by, like you said, making a bigger profit. And that's been one of the problems, too. You know, we give so many incentives for American businesses to move their operations abroad. They pay less. They don't produce as much. And then we suffer because of the supply chain problem. And then a lot of the stuff that we import is not even healthy. And we don't realize that because they don't meet the same standards that we do here in the United States. We've got different rules and regulations. So
oh, yeah.
It becomes really a big problem. And is there an oversight committee for this sort of stuff that happens? I mean,
well,
I saw that you were working with the was it Public Service Commission, and look at what they've gotten away with, the atrocities that they've gotten away with for so long. And
you're right.
Luckily,
you're, right.
You're overlooking that, and you're setting that straight. That's
well,
huge.
You know, well, very often you're right. You know, we set these public service commissions, and you know, these so-called agencies that, you know, many work, and some of them don't work to my full satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a lot of positive things we, of course, talk about. But when it came to, for example, utility companies and energy companies,
yeah.
and, you know, we speak a lot about how lately, whether it's climate control or other factors, you know, we're witnessing a lot more severe storms and concerns,
yeah.
where, you know, there's power outages, there's downed trees, there's interruption of services, you know. Very often, you know, you start looking into it and you realize how dangerous it is for many. When there's an electric outage, you know, we don't realize many disabled individuals and senior citizens and others that rely on life-saving equipment, for example, you know, without energy, without electricity, you know, people that are on ventilators and oxygen masks and a lot of other necessities, you know, these people can die, they can suffer. So, you know, when
but
I looked
ask
at
you,
that,
I thought they made a ruling or a requirement that all those people who have that sort of need are the first one on the list, and they have to have, you know, a power backup, don't they? Or maybe I'm wrong.
They had a list, but they had no time requirements. I passed legislation.
So that's,
I had passed legislation last month. The Assembly and Senate passed my legislation that authorizes or requires companies, utility companies, not just to pick on Con Ed, but utility companies across, that people that are on medical necessity equipment, you know, within 24 hours must be given immediate care. We also passed legislation that requires utility companies to really put together a full plan to monitor and follow up on generators, on police and fire and EMS and emergency services, to make sure that their generators are working. If not, to have backup generators, to have, imagine, God forbid, there's a storm, there's a family member who's seriously ill, and then the police station or the ambulance or the EMS doesn't have electricity, and therefore they can't respond, they can't get the information in a timely fashion, or a fire department that is unable to send out a fire truck to put out a fire, or a police department that's unable to try to save a life or avoid a crime or avoid another matter. These legislative pieces were part of a package that I put forth in the Assembly and in the Senate, had people co-sponsor. And even this past week, I was very proud that two SAGE bills, you know, both dealing with utility companies, were also passed. So I had like four bills on utilities that really put utility companies on notice, holds them accountable, gives them a very specific time frame. For example, one of my bills, Assembly Bill 3245, was basically saying, hey, it relates to emergency response plans relating to down wires, where within 24 hours, for example, they have to have a plan. They have to make sure they have emergency backup systems. We spoke in the show how in the past, to save money, they would have utility repair companies from Ohio and Pennsylvania and elsewhere try to respond because they were cheaper. This puts them on notice. And that's where you know, the weakness of the Public Service Commission that should be doing this, where, you know, they allow companies to get away with too much, not only the energy sector,
well,
but
the Public Service Commission allowed the Con Edison, for example, to hang around for 3 days before there was any response. And
yeah,
that you had to have special people from Con Ed to make a decision whether something needed work or didn't. And
you're right.
I thought didn't your legislation pass that anybody could call up and say, hey,
anybody,
you got a problem here?
That's the difference. See, people would initially look at something and say, oh, well, we have something in place. But what they had in place was, as long as a Con Edison, for example, or a utility company official, you know, made the call and said, hey, we got a down tree here, it's on wires, it's on a car, it's on a home of an individual. Now, this legislation, not only a Con Ed official, but any individual. So if you're a property owner, you're a homeowner, and you call Con Edison and you say, hey, I got a down tree here, then the clock clicks from that point on. You know, they have 36 hours to make sure they remove that. And if they need to bring in heavy equipment, whatever, they need to make sure when there isn't a storm, what we're saying to these utility companies, we want you to be prepared. We don't want you to panic when a storm comes and then the left hand doesn't know what the right hand. We want you to have plans in place, to have backup systems in place, to have generators that are backup, to make sure there's a list of people with medical necessities, to make sure police, fire, and ambulance get restored as, you know, sooner than later. And this is the type of legislation. The other one, the other bill also...
Before you go on to the other bill, you know, what's very interesting is, too, that when it comes to being responsive, the fact that Con Ed gets 36 hours to contend with an issue gave them, Con Ed, an opportunity to hire even companies from Louisiana, and it may have taken them 3 days to get up to New York, but it ended up costing New York a lot more money because of the crisis that was lasting for 3 days before they could respond. And why is it that they have the audacity to bring in people and resources from outside the state when we have the resources here? We've got the personnel.
Well,
we've got the equipment. So why are they committed to do that?
Well, you know, prior they were thinking of, you know, profit making. They had you know, revenue was always on their mind, you know. And so we're saying, hey, we know as a business, you know, you got to report to management, to shareholders, to people that, you know, are putting pressure on you, administration or management, to make a profit, for example. So we understand that dynamic. But, you know, from the same token, you know, when you're a utility company, you have a greater responsibility, you know, to the general safety of the public at large. And therefore, you know, you gotta be held accountable to make sure that, you know, if the safety of my customers or my constituents is such where it would be dampened or hampered, you know, then I got to put aside, well, I can save a few dollars by bringing a utility repair company from Pennsylvania
or
Ohio.
It doesn't save us any money.
It saves
a utility company money, but it costs us more money because without the backup, for a lot of the equipment, including food and drugs that spoil when there's no electrical power, is there still a discrepancy between New York City? If you live in New York City and your food spoils or your drugs spoil because of a lack of power, they get reimbursed in New York City. But I don't think in Westchester County we get the same sort of standard.
Well, before...
Unless they change that.
Well, we're looking to change that. There's legislation in place that demands...
God bless you
that,
for that. Why are they getting away with murder?
They were getting away with it, where in the past people had to reach out to Con Edison. They were given the runaround. They had to show a lot of proof. So the part of the legislation that's, you know, being pushed forces Con Ed, whenever there's that there's automatic notice given to Con Edison that, hey, this region has been, let's say, without power for a day or two. And, you know, there's an automatic assumption of spoilage. So anybody that submits X amount of bills or receipts to show, you know, whether they purchased meat or purchased other perishable products,
drugs, or drugs also.
A lot of drugs, for example, insulin. A lot of people are on insulin. And insulin during the summertime, if it's not refrigerated, you know, and it's extremely costly. You know, people don't realize the cost of insulin. And sometimes people, if they miss their insulin and their sugar is high and they have either type 1 or 2 diabetes, I mean, it could be life-threatening. It could be very dangerous. And, you know, so these are the type of things that, you know, just on the field of utility, you know, I've put together a package of some 7-8 bills. And, you know, four of them have been passed already. And, you know, I'd like to say at the end of this session, among a lot of other areas, that we are able to produce, we're able to promote meaningful changes in policy and legislation so that, you know, I can feel safer, my family, our neighbors can feel safer, God forbid, when the next storm. And years ago, we used to say, well, the storm of the century. You know, now we got to assume every season, every year, there's going to be bad hurricanes.
There's going to be bad storms.
And it's happening. Even lately, you know, between minor earthquakes or between tornadoes or, you know, it's not something that's uncommon no more. You know, so we got to be better prepared. You know, and safety is the main thing, safety and constituent services.
Absolutely. I wanted to get make sure that we have enough time to spend. You evidently attended an event with His Majesty King Abdullah II and his wife, Queen Reina. And, this was down at, I guess it was at the United Nations. And,
on Park Avenue, close to the UN. It was at a facility, but a high-class catering place. And this was sponsored by an organization called Path to Peace. It's an international type of organization. And I guess they rotate, but this past year of time, the Holy See, if you know, the Vatican is considered like a government, and they have a permanent observer at the United Nations. And so their Archbishop, Kachachia, Nunzia Kachachia, was the president of this organization. So the Holy See technically ran this event. And each year, as part of the Path to Peace initiative, which is to promote interfaith dialogue and peaceful coexistence, they recognize or honor individuals that truly, you know, commit or make contributions to world peace. And King Abdullah and the Hashemites for the last 100 years, you know, have been very instrumental, especially in the Middle East, in promoting, you know, Muslim-Christian dialogue and making sure that, especially in a country like Jordan, where the Christians are a small minority, you know, they felt, of course, you know, that the king, you know, was fair and neutral and really put forth policies in Jordan that protected all faiths. And it was a worthy event. I really enjoyed it and, you know, went there and listened to the king speak, you know, very eloquent, very strong British dialogue. I don't know if people know, but the king's mother was British. And he was educated in England, and so he was well educated, and really, along with the Queen, they came to New York, and they met a lot of people there, and it was enjoyable. You know, for me, it was, you know, it was part of my role over the last year, working with the World Yoga Association and Many international and local interfaith organizations. A real good friend of mine, Guruji Dilipi, is world known. He's one of the leaders of the interfaith peace movement, and you know, I've been a guest speaker on many of his international shows, celebrating, you know, various holidays, Diwali and World Yoga Day, and we put forth resolutions at the assembly level honoring this interfaith and yoga and world peace celebrations. And to me, you know, that's part of my role on the international scene to really promote world peace. And so, you know, for me to visit the kings.
Well, I think what's really important is, I don't know if a lot of people realize that you speak Arabic and you speak quite a few languages.
Yes.
That must give a sense also that the city of Yonkers that you represent has an international flavor and an understanding. Does that make a big impression, I think, on the international stage? I think it must.
Well, it does. You know, Yonkers, as you said, is blessed with being very diversified. It's like a mini United Nations. You find
really,
about 100
like 60 different ethnicities that live
I
can't
even like,
60.
even more. I think they're talking about like 100 different languages or dialects that are spoken in Yonkers.
Wow.
And Yonkers, you know, for years has encouraged this respect for diversity, where you have the annual flag raising at City Hall for like practically every ethnic group. You have you know, you have various celebrations, you know, where we encourage cultural interaction, you know, and for me, I love that. I love, you know, to be able to attend events where you can learn the cuisine and the music and the dance of the different cultures and people. And as an educator, I pushed this concept as a school principal and as a board president for years, where we motivated schools to have these cultural celebrations where, you know, kids can understand each other, they can respect each other, whether it's the different races or ethnicities or cultures or traditions, and really become more, what I always say, global citizens of the world. You know, it's not like the old days where you grew up in Yonkers and, you know, you had generations that stayed here, and generally, the sons or daughters did what the fathers and mothers did as careers, and they maintained their residence here. Times have changed now. You know, our children are getting educated. They're moving out of state. They're moving out of the country.
Yeah.
They're involved with, you know, national and international businesses and corporations. And now it becomes urgent that they become global. Now, what does it mean become global? If you're working for an international company and they're doing business in Europe or the Middle East or Asia or the Far East, you got to be able to know the customs in those areas. If you go to Japan and you're dealing with, you know, business in Japan, you got to be able, as a representative of whatever company you're working for, to understand the gestures, you know, that are respected, for example, by Japanese or by Middle Easterners or Asians or Latinos. And a lot of times, you know, without those skills or appreciation, you know, you're at a disadvantage because, you know, I think we all know that, you know, a student that comes from Europe or from other parts of the world, you know, it's automatic that they speak two languages and three languages and more.
Yeah.
You know, here in America, only recently we started to push that, hey, you know, don't feel comfortable just speaking English. You know, you got to realize, even here in America, whether you're a doctor or lawyer in any profession, when you speak Spanish or you speak Arabic or you speak French or you speak other languages, you know, it gives you that advantage. It gives you that ability to communicate with people more because without those skills, you're at a disadvantage. When I was an educator for years, was a big advocate of dual language programs where, you know, we encourage our students, not English language learners, even English speakers, you know, at the early stages to take Spanish or to take French or Italian or any other language, mm-hmm. where you know, the goal was, we want you to start off early learning at least two languages. And some of that has worked. You know, we got a way to go here in Yonkers and elsewhere. You know, we're still at a stage where we're pushing American society to recognize that we need to be more globally oriented. But we're getting there slowly.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, you know, where do you focus most of your attention now, or is it constantly fluid because there's so many issues and concerns? And then you also have to be supportive of other representatives, other assembly people in the city, because
sure.
in the state, because they come to you for support and you come to them for support.
Of course.
Is that simple? Is that really simple to do? Because, you know, at my age, for example, I wonder, you know, how you foster relationships. It's one thing to do it when you're in your 20s. It's another thing for me to do it in my 70s. So I really wonder if that's so easy, or if people are reluctant to stretch their arm and to shake hands and to, hey, sit down and say, oh, let's work something out here.
But,
or
you know, for me, you know, I'm an attorney, of course, you know, so I deal a lot with constituents, with clients, you know, but my main career for 40 plus years was as an educator. I was a teacher. I was a college mm-hmm. professor. I served mm-hmm. over 30 years as a school principal and board of ed president.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, you know, lifelong, before my role as a state assemblyman, my role has always been, and I appreciate it, and I really loved dealing with people, socializing. You know, I considered myself intergenerational. I was able and trained early on, you know, to deal with children, to deal with, you know, senior citizens, and really relate mm-hmm. to them at their levels. And that type of upbringing, that type of training really allowed me to appreciate interaction with people and public service and volunteerism. And for many mm-hmm. years, you know, many years ago, became a trustee of the Yonkers Parks Board. I served and represented senior citizen centers and developed programs at the parks and multicultural programs and a lot of initiatives that promoted youth sports and sports for the disabled and so forth, and then served as chairman of the Yonkers Parking Authority, which was like a semi-private governmental agency dealing with parking. And people say, well, is that important? Of course. How can you have business development without having plans for parking? If you build a 100-unit mm-hmm. building, can you build a building without considering, hey, if each unit, each family had at least one car, you know, do you have enough parking? Do you have enough parking mm-hmm. for visitors? If you're building a shopping center, do you have enough parking for customers mm-hmm. to come in and go out and so forth? So, you know, these type of agencies, whether youth organizations, senior citizen organizations, multicultural, I've done it over the years. And, you know, to me, when it wasn't popular 40 years ago to reach out to Hispanics, I served as a trustee of the Spanish Foundation at a time when, mm-hmm. you know, it was a growing community in Southwest Yonkers and people weren't really even paying attention. We reached out and we served and we encouraged organizations like Catholic Charities and others to really promote more funding and more interaction there. And then as time went on, whether serving on other scholarship foundations, you know, to motivate students, the Enrico Fermi Scholarship, and many others, the Khalil Gibran derived out of the Enrico Fermi Foundation, you mm-hmm. know, as far as the model of how to give scholarships and how to encourage young men and women to really excel and go to colleges and get careers and to give them scholarships, to say, you know what, we really appreciate your success. As the board president was around when we initiated My Brother's Keeper, You know, that to me is one of the greatest programs that motivates and advances, you know, young children of color and really gives them the opportunity to have mentors and people that support them and people that motivate them. And this is part of the many factors, you know, that attribute to making academics more accessible and more enjoyable and more meaningful for children. I was a big advocate as a principal to push in Yonkers after school programs and support service programs that brought up test scores in English language arts and math. And this is something that, you know, even as an early young school principal realized that the more opportunities you can give children, the more you can promote learning even for adults and parents. We pushed adult education. We pushed, you know, special training. Kids that, for example, young men and women that didn't have a proper opportunity, that were dropouts, we pushed them back into the school setting, allowed them to get GEDs and go to colleges, and, you know, the rest is history. Today I deal with major employers and major labor leaders, people that are extremely successful, that we look back many years ago and they say, you know, Mr. Sayage or Dr. Sayage, you know, back then you gave me the chance and, you know, I was a dropout and you helped me get the training and the GED and I went on and got a college degree and now I'm president.
But toward all of that, when like I'm only in Yonkers now, in the news business for 24 years. That's it. So the thing that's very interesting is that when I reflect back on Yonkers history, it was practically nothing to where it is today. It has evolved in the last two and a half decades, actually, to such
Correct.
An extent and. And you were instrumental in that too, because of all the different positions and that you held in all those years. You know, part of government and ancillary to government and advocacy and language and learning and teaching and all that stuff and law. Do you find that it's now easier for Yonkers to have earned the respect that it's earned in the last 24 years? Does it help?
Well, I think so. I think it helps a lot. I think, you know, people recognize, you know, with the last census, we moved up from the fourth largest city to the third largest city.
Yes.
So psychologically, you know, it just gives an image that, wow, this is a city on the roll. This is a city that is growing. You know, people know, hey, this is a city that borders the Hudson River, faces the Palisades, you know, borders New York City. You know, so we're like in the midst of it all. Yonkers, New York really is in a very unique geographic situation. And as we spoke about, the flavor of Yonkers, the diversity, you look at the growth taking place in the city on the waterfront and elsewhere, you know, with the potential soon of the expansion of MGM, Empire Casino, you know, I see us growing from this small town image to this, you know, becoming a city metropolitan. But we got to be able to plan ahead. We got to make sure that, you know, our planning department conforms to making sure that even though we may support business and advancement, we don't take away from the flavor of Yonkers. You don't make it, you know, inconvenient for property owners and homeowners. So that's where government has to be very responsive. They got to be smart. You got to be very fair. So you can wear two hats. You can wear a hat that wants development, wants growth, but at the same time, hey, not at the expense of our residents. So where do we find common ground where we can grow, we can advance, but at the same time, not to ruin the flavor of the communities we have or the enjoyment. Now, for example, you have a lot of development that's taken place on the Hudson River, for example, the waterfront.
Right.
And, you know, from one end, you know, you love to see development and growth, but from the other end, you know, where does it stop, or is there a limit? You know, there's a lot of residents that live in Yonkers, especially in that region, that are very frustrated that, you know, they once used to have so much parkland or open land that they can enjoy on a beautiful day to go and just to relax and have some fresh air and look at the Palisades and the river. So if we allow big business to continue to, let's say, deprive individuals of that enjoyment, that's one of those areas, for example, that we as legislators got to find common ground where can you as a developer, you know, achieve your building plans and development, but at the same time, make sure there's adequate parkland, make sure there's accessibility for residents to enjoy the parkland, so that at the end of the day, it's a win-win from both ends. And that's the type of thing that day in and day out, I try to prize myself with being open-minded, with being a negotiator, with being somebody that, you know, at the end of the day, if you can avoid losers, it's a win-win. You know, so anytime there's issues where there's debate, at least I would attempt to get people together to communicate, well, what's your issue? What's your concern? And then to ask the other side, what's your concerns? What are your wishes? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do we agree upon? I always say, look at the commonality. When we preached, you know, this global citizen of the world, my theme was always to people, hey, you know, at the very least, we're 90% common. You know, it doesn't matter what your religion or your race or how you look and your traditions. You know, the fact is 90% of who we are as human beings is common. So there is so much more commonality we have than differences. So that's why when people realize and you get people together and they break bread together, they speak to each other, then they realize, hey, this person isn't that bad, you know, and they begin to realize, I really had a misconception. You know, sometimes people automatically hate someone because of perception or politics or, you know, or stigmas that they were taught early on. And that's what we need to get rid of. It's to get rid of that negative energy, that negative vibe. And the way to do that is openness, honesty, communications, and really teaching people that.
Do you think that is an Americanism? Because there's a much greater divide, you know, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe even, in South America. Or is that very much part of that immigrant, immigration to America? Is that the reason why we mix well together, even though there may be differences among us?
Well, historically,
are we coalescing into a nation? I don't
know.
When
you look at our history, when you study American history and you look at, you know, foreign immigration, I mean, when the people that first came here during colonial times, I mean, they were immigrants. They came here from England and Europe and, you know, they settled here. You know, they weren't too kind to the Indians that were here. And, you know, and now, you know, they, of course, that branch looks at themselves as pure Americans, but they started as immigrants here. And then you had other people during the century or two, you know, from other parts of Europe, the Middle East, the Far East, Latin America. You know, generation after generation come here, and every ethnic group will tell you that when they came here, they felt there was either a sense of discrimination or disappreciation.
Yeah.
Because anytime there's a new group, you know, right away the people that are here before them feel, wow, they're here, they're going to take our jobs, they're going to take our, you know, benefits here, they're going to live on the system. And, you know, generation after generation, if they need help, they receive help, but then they educate themselves, their children, for example, they move on, they become part of the establishment, and then a new generation comes in, a new ethnic group, a new immigrant population.
Right.
And it's a cycle. And I've seen it even in places like Yonkers, where over the last 60 years, different ethnic groups that came to Yonkers, for example, settled in Southwest Yonkers. They became successful. They opened up businesses. Then they ended up buying nice homes in other parts of the city and the county, and some moved out of state.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they look to the other new group that's in Southwest Yonkers as an immigrant group in a different way.
Mm.
And we're saying, look, it's a process. It's a process. Learn to respect. Learn to recognize that, you know, when we grow out of our initial stages as immigrants and move on, you know, we got to recognize and respect that whoever replaced us is taking on the manual labor jobs. They're working in restaurants, the hands-on jobs that now
mm-hmm.
many of us don't want to do. So, you know, it's that understanding. It's that understanding that I try to encourage among people to understand history, understand the patterns, and understand that in many ways, some of these new generations or groups are going through what my generation went through. You know, don't forget your upbringing. Don't forget your past, your family's past, your ethnic past,
mm-hmm.
and learn from that. You know, but too often we become too close-minded, and that's where bigotry and sometimes, you know, resentment takes place. The whole issue with the borders, many ethnic groups or immigrant groups will say, well, historically, I came here the legal way, and I did it the legal way. Why mm-hmm. open borders? And sometimes you hear this from immigrant groups themselves that say, well, I had to go through the formal process. Why does somebody else just be allowed to skip through the border and come in, and when I had
mm-hmm.
to go through a process? So it's a debate that goes on. We as government, sometimes you have to find a balance. You got to make sure that if somebody's here in our borders, do you ignore them when they have health care needs? Do you ignore them when they have, you know, educational needs? You know, and I always err on the side of, you know, you can't ignore any human being. Anytime there's a need, you
mm-hmm.
got to try to reach out. You got to try to help them. And at the same time, look at policy and procedures that, you know, reflect stability in our nation, in our communities. Like we said earlier about finding common ground with business, finding common ground with landlords and tenants, with affordable housing and business development. Anything we do, you know, our role is to try to be balanced, to try to be open-minded, to try to find common ground, because, you know, you can't have winners and losers. Anytime in anything we do in life and society, it's not good when you have to have winners and losers. Even when
do you think that this is a sort it's almost like a lifestyle? Do you think that people respect that, or are they still constantly changing, or does life change for them? Do they realize that, hey, we need to work together as a community? Is Yonkers getting better at it than it ever was? I don't think it was as good 24 years ago.
No, I think it's getting better. I think if enough of us keep pushing the concept, and, you know, I remember, you know, about a year and a half ago, we started pushing this weekly news report, you know, from my assembly office, you know, where this, we send it to nearly 7,000 people, where it really
mm-hmm.
gives the listener, you know, an email form, you know, on Facebook and other sources, you know, a report of what took place during the week, legislation in Albany, local news, events I attended, constituents
mm-hmm.
I meet with, you know, information about available programs and services from the city, from the county, from other levels. And, you know, and lately I see a lot of other public officials and legislators are doing likewise, you know, but
mm-hmm.
for me, you know, I don't look at it and say, well, that's something I started doing. Why is other people doing it? You know, I've always been, even as an educator, a big promoter of best practices. So anything that
mm-hmm.
works well, you don't want to just leave it limited to a small group or one individual or one school. You want to make sure that if there's a good practice, what I call a best practice, You want that best practice applied everywhere. So when I see that nearly every public official now has their weekly newsletter, you know, to me it promotes where more awareness, people are better informed, and we all know that the more informed people are, the better it is. The more people know about available services during the pandemic, to know where and how to get vaccines, how to apply for small business applications, how to get help on the federal level, if it's an immigration problem, if it's a problem with the federal taxation department or state department. It's that type of networking, it's that type of outreach that really promotes, you know, more awareness. And the more information you put out, you disseminate, it really helps. When we tell seniors, we reach out and tell them, hey, there's a lot of scams going on. This is what you got to be careful. Don't fall for these scams. Or if you have, you know, from the health perspective, the more information we tell individuals, you know, if you're getting headaches or if you feel, you know, you have high blood pressure or you feel you have diabetes and these are the symptoms, make sure you get tested. Make sure you get, you know, annual physicals, for example. If you have a concern, you know, seek medical attention. These are the awareness from God knows how many facets, how many areas that, you know, you try to disseminate this information, you know, so that people are safer, people are more alert, there's less scamming, there's less, you know, health issues because people don't know any better. And that's what, you know, at the end of the day, our role, even though we spoke about being global and being statewide, I would still say that the bulk of my efforts, in addition to that approach, is, you know, what I do for Yonkers. I mean, I'm the only assemblyman that represents fully the city of Yonkers. And I'm proud that for education, you know, some $25 million we brought in for education. And I've been like, you know, the fighter up there in Albany to make sure Yonkers Public Schools and education is funded, so we have sports and music and art and library, to make sure that, you know, we're not terminating or laying off teachers or you know, having high class sizes where kids can learn. You know, God knows this year, you know, I'm so happy with a lot of additional funding from state and federal for Yonkers, $8 million Soy Mill River redevelopment projects. You know how many people in the Soy Mill River Valley in Yonkers over the years with the serious flooding problems and others, you know, have for decades complained about, you know, let's do something about it. This is a big piece of funds that allows us to do that. You know, the $19.6 million from Video Lottery, from Empire Casino, with MGM, hopefully that'll go up to $25, $30 million we can start. People don't know, $25 million for Teachers of Tomorrow Awards, $100,000 Educators for Student Success to work on after-school programs for Yonkers kids, $91,000 for Yonkers Sewer District projects. This way, people that see streets, cave-ins, sewer systems that are either damaged or not functioning, you know, the municipality has a hard time sometimes funding these things. But these are the type of things that, you know, at the end of every budget season, I look at and I say, well, where are the wins did we get? You know, the state delegation and I, what can we say, hey, this is what we've done in Albany. This is what we've done to bring the funds to Yonkers to protect the best interests of Yonkers. Again, statewide too. The state had a $220 billion budget. I mean, that was one of the largest budgets. So our goal was, we want to make sure as the third largest city in the state, we got our share for that. You know, and I got to say, even though we're moving in the right direction, I'm still fighting very hard to change the way the state funds education, because I still believe whether it's the building aid fund or the fund for educating our kids, we're shortchanged. And some of my colleagues would disagree, but
I still feel that's unfair, it's unethical, it's inequitable, and I'll continue to fight. And I have legislation. I'm not backing off till we get our fair share.
That's what we need. So thank God for that. Well, as usual, it's always a pleasure. I look forward to every week. You inform me so much, and I think you're doing an unbelievably brilliant job. So thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I'm sure Yonkers thanks you, whether they know it or they don't.
Well, Hadzi, thank you. You know, we always speak about the awareness, and with your ongoing efforts to make us aware and bring in speakers on and giving us an opportunity to communicate and express what we feel and what we do and what we desire to do is always very fruitful and helpful. So, you know, the credit is to you and other individuals that are really allowing us the avenue and the means to express our views. But thank you so much, Hezzy.
Oh, thank you. All the best. Enjoy the weekend.
Take care. You too.
See
Bye-bye.
You well. Thank you, sir. And there we have it, the one and only assembly member representing the city of Yonkers, and that's from Assembly District number 90, and it's represented naturally by Dr. Nader Sayers, who's also a lawyer on top of everything else and an educator. He's got so many hats he wears, I don't know how he puts it all together, but evidently he's got it working, and it's working good. So we're going to move on to another issue, and we're going to be moving on to the international stage. There are a couple of things that we need to really look into. And I guess the first thing is something that's happening from Germany, which is very interesting. Germany's Chancellor Scholz and Russia's Putin are going to discuss stalled peace talks, and this is what's going on. So for the in their first phone call in weeks, Germany's Scholz and Russia's Putin spoke about the war in Ukraine, and meanwhile the European Union said it would provide Ukraine with another 500 million euros for military aid. So the European Union pledges are an additional 500 million euros in aid to Ukraine for heavy weapons. Russia's Putin and Germany's Scholz spoke on the phone in their first call in weeks. Ukraine, in a new bid to negotiate the evacuation of the Azovstal fighters that are still left there in the steel plant. And President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Russia's strategic defeat is already obvious. And the first war crimes trial of Russian soldiers has started in Kyiv. Well, Russian clubs appeal the UEFA decision to bar them from competition. Teams of four Russian Premier League clubs have filed an appeal against European football's governing body, the UEFA, and their decision to bar Russian clubs from European competition next season. Zenit Football Club are supported in this action by the FC Dynamo Moscow, and the FC Sochi, and the PFC CSKA Moscow in appealing against a decision by the UEFA, and respectfully request this appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to be dealt with expeditiously, as Zenit had said in a statement. Zenit is like Zenith. So last week, UEFA announced that men's and women's teams in Russia would be excluded from European club competition in the 2022-2023 season as a result of Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Well, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke on the phone on Friday, Ukraine peace talks, both governments confirmed. Putin reportedly told the German leader that peace talks on the conflict had been essentially blocked by the Ukrainian government. And the Kremlin said in a statement, that was their statement, and Putin also told Scholz that Moscow was fighting, quote, Nazi ideology in Ukraine, which is absurd, but that's what he said. In a tweet, Scholz confirmed the call took place, saying he'd urged Putin for a rapid ceasefire in Ukraine. He also emphasized that the Russian leader's claims that Nazis are in charge of the country is false, quote unquote. And thank God he said that. Also, the German chancellor said, I also reminded him about Russia's responsibility for the global food situation. So a German government statement said that the call lasted about 75 minutes. In addition to quickly implementing a ceasefire, Scholz called on Putin to quickly, quote, improve the humanitarian situation on the ground and make progress in the search for a diplomatic solution to the conflict. Well, the United Kingdom also announced sanctions on Russian individuals. It seems that British Foreign Minister, actually Secretary Liz Truss, said that London is imposing a new round of sanctions targeting Russian President Vladimir Putin's network, including his ex-wife, alleged girlfriend, and cousins. Quote, we are exposing and targeting the shady network propping up Putin's luxury lifestyle and tightening the vise on his inner circle, Truss said in a statement. We will keep going with sanctions on all those aiding and abetting Putin's aggression until Ukraine prevails, end quote. Well, the sanctioned individuals include Putin's ex-wife, Ludmila Osheretnaya, and Alina Kabeeva, a former Olympic gymnast who the British government said was, quote, alleged to have a close personal relationship with Putin, end quote. A Russian soldier is appearing before a court in Kyiv over the killing of a 62-year-old unarmed Ukrainian civilian. Ukrainian prosecutors say the 21-year-old soldier shot the man in the head through an open car window in the northeastern Ukrainian village of Chupakivka. The trial is the first prosecution of a Russian military member for a war crime in Ukraine since the war started on February 24. Well, Ukrainian Prosecutor General Irina Venediktova's office is looking into more than 10,700 potential war crimes involving more than 600 suspects. On May 4, the Security Service of Ukraine, the SBU, posted a short video of the Russian soldier speaking in front of a camera and briefly describing how he shot the man. The SBU described the video as one of the first confessions of the enemy invaders. And Ukraine has been criticized by rights groups who say Kyiv is violating the Geneva Conventions by publishing footage and images of prisoners of war. A coordinator for the Center for Civil Liberties, one of Ukraine's biggest human rights groups, said that activists would be monitoring the trial to ensure the suspect's legal rights are protected, noting that it can be difficult to maintain judicial neutrality during wartime. The observance of the trial's rules and norms, quote, will determine how similar cases will be handled in the future, said Vladimir Yavorovsky of the Center for Civil Liberties. Now, Germany's Scholz wants to hold talks with Putin, so says a report. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz told lawmakers that he wants to hold fresh talks with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Lawmakers from his Social Democratic Party, the SPD, were quoted as saying by the news agency, and I heard clearly that the chancellor also announced a new initiative for talks with Putin. The news agency DPA quoted as saying that lawmakers Wolfgang Helmich after a Bundestag Defense Committee meeting. According to Helmich, Scholz had earlier said that the conflict could not be resolved without channels for dialogue. The German leader had spoken to Putin multiple times since the Russian invasion of Ukraine started on February 24. Well, Germany Agriculture Minister, hold on a second, Cem Özdemir, meeting with G7 and Ukrainian colleagues, said that grain theft by Russian forces in eastern Ukraine was repugnant, quote unquote. This is an especially repugnant form of war that Russia is leading, and that it is stealing, robbing, taking for itself grain from the eastern Ukraine, Ozdemir said at the start of a G7 meeting. Ukraine's agriculture minister, Mykola Solsky, said he feared great losses in this year's wheat harvest because of the war. Solsky called for support for Ukraine in transporting grain, saying his country cannot solve the issue single-handedly. Ukraine is traditionally a major wheat exporter. According to Solsky, the country's harvest this year will be much smaller than last year's because half of the wheat cultivation land for winter is located in areas that are either witnessing intense fighting or are occupied by Russian forces. The minister said that Ukraine's allies must work to end a blockade on Black Sea ports for grain export. Well, European Union is going to provide Ukraine with another $500 million in military aid. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, announced that the bloc was set to increase military aid to Ukraine with a further $520 million, that's 500 million euros. Borrell made the announcement on the sidelines of a G7 foreign ministers meeting in Germany. A new impetus for military support, it will be more pressure on Russia with economic sanctions and continuing the international isolation of Russia and countering misinformation, he said. And the latest aid package would increase the European Union's funds for Ukraine's military support to a total of 2 billion euros, Borrell had said. Well, the European Union's top diplomat also said it was optimistic that a European Union embargo on Russian oil imports could also be agreed to in the coming days. I'm sure we will have an agreement. We need it and we will have it because we have to get rid of the oil dependency from Russia, he said. If there is no agreement at the level of ambassadors, then on Monday the ministers, when they gather, will have to provide the political impetus. Well, the United Kingdom's trust calls for a further G7 pressure on Russia. British Foreign Ministry, Foreign Secretary, rather, Liz Truss, said that supplying Moscow with more weapons and imposing further sanctions on Russia, so supplying Ukraine with more weapons and imposing further sanctions on Russia, was needed to increase pressure on Moscow. It is very important at this time that we keep up the pressure on Russian President Vladimir Putin by supplying more weapons to Ukraine, by increasing the sanctions, Truss said as she arrived for a second day of talks with her G7 counterparts in Germany. G7 unity has been vital during this crisis, she added. Three-day meeting, running until Saturday, brings together diplomats from Britain, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, the United States, and the European Union to a 400-year-old castle estate in the Baltic Sea resort of Waisenhaus in Germany. The foreign ministers of Ukraine and its neighbor Moldova, which is feared as a possible first target of another attack by Russia, were also attending. The German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock expressed the G7 support for Moldova as she spoke with her Moldovan counterpart on the sidelines of the summit. Baerbock told Moldova's Nicu Popescu, "It was a pleasure to see him for the third time in 3 months, even though the situation is the opposite of a pleasure." Ukrainian forces are gaining momentum amid the fierce fighting in the Donbas region. Deutsche Welle's correspondent in Kyiv, Fani Faksar, said that Ukraine's counteroffensive in the east of the country seems to be working, end quote. Faksar said there had been fierce fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces trying to maintain control of villages in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas. From what we're hearing, that at this point, the Russian forces seem to have a headway there, while at the same time, Ukrainian forces seem to advance as well, because the weapons actually from the West did arrive, Faksar had said. But the question is really whether this momentum that seems to be now rather working for Ukrainian forces whether they can maintain this momentum, she added. Well, as far as the United Kingdom is concerned, Russia is investing significant effort to isolate Ukraine forces in the east. The British Defense Ministry said that Russia was investing significant effort near the eastern Ukrainian cities of Izium and Severodonetsk to isolate Ukrainian forces. According to a United Kingdom Defense Intelligence report, Russia's main goal is to envelop Ukrainian forces to isolate them from support from the west of the country. Meanwhile, Ukraine foiled an attempt by Russian forces to cross a river in Donbass, the report said. Conducting river crossings in a contested environment is a highly risky maneuver and speaks to the pressure the Russian commanders are under to make progress in their operations in eastern Ukraine. Russian forces have failed to make any significant advances despite concentrating forces in the area after withdrawing and redeploying units from the Kyiv and Chernihiv oblasts or regions. European industrial manufacturing company Siemens AG has announced that it will be exiting Russia after nearly 170 years of operating there. We condemn the war in Ukraine and have decided to carry out an orderly process to wind down our industrial business activities in Russia, said CEO Roland Busch on Thursday. According to its statement, Siemens was one of the first companies to put all new business in an international delivery to Russia on hold while it evaluated the situation to ensure the safety of its 3,000 employees in the country. Well, the United Nations, along with several aid organizations, say that women are bearing the brunt of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There have been an increasing number of reports from civilians of sexual violence in areas that had been under Russian control. Human rights lawyer Oleksandr Matvichuk heads up the Center for Civil Liberties in Kyiv and told Deutsche Welle that sexual violence is what she called the most hidden crime, end quote. It is very difficult to speak, and that's why sexual violence is the most hidden crime, and survivors of sexual violence very often not apply to police nor to human rights defenders because they consider this crime as a shame. Matvichuk said that rape was a way of targeting Ukrainian society and that one of the consequences has been fear, which has allowed Russian forces to gain a level of control. Through the concrete victims of rapes, Russian soldiers targeted Ukrainian society. Some people feel guilty because they couldn't protect and stop it, and other people feel fear to be treated in the same way. So it provides a frozen effect to resistance, and that's why we consider that Russians use rape as a part of a terror against civilians in order to quickly obtain control over the region. Ukraine hopes for more German assistance on a path toward the European Union membership. Ukraine's ambassador to Germany, Andriy Melnyk, said he expects Germany to do more to help Ukraine's accession to the European Union. Besides arms deliveries and the tightening sanctions, our main goal is to get support for accession to the European Union, Melnyk said in a pre-printed report by German newspaper network Redaktionsnetzwerk Deutschland, RND. A decision on Ukraine's candidate status is expected by the end of June. So we've got another month and a half. And Ukraine's Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk has said that efforts were underway to try and rescue besieged troops still holed up in the Azovstal steelworks complex in Mariupol. We have started a new round of negotiations, Vereshchuk said, according to local publication Ukrainska Pravda. So it's Ukrainian Truth, the newspaper. We would like to have a deal designed or signed, rather, on how the evacuations from Azovstal will proceed. We are ready to sign, Vereshchuk had said. The deputy prime minister said the priority would be to evacuate 38 seriously injured soldiers. Ukraine is also willing to exchange Russian prisoners of war in return for the injured Azovstal fighters. and Russia has demanded the surrender of the Ukrainian soldiers in the complex and has thus far refused an evacuation of the remaining forces. Last week, Ukraine said that the remaining women, children, and elderly had been evacuated from the steel plant after having spent weeks under siege. Well, Russia's strategic defeat is obvious, says Zelensky. In his nightly video address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Moscow's defeat is, quote, obvious to everyone in the world and also to those who still communicate with them, meaning the Russians. Zelensky said that rather than admit defeat, Russia has hid behind artillery bombardments. Quote, they are cowards and try to hide this behind new missile and artillery attacks, Zelensky said. The Ukrainian president's remarks come as Russia continues its offensive in the eastern Donbas region of Ukraine. Ukraine's military said it had captured some towns and villages in the country's northeast outside of Kharkiv, but acknowledged that Russian forces have seen partial success further south. In the area around Severodonetsk, the enemy is conducting attacks on Kudryashkivka and Severodonetsk and is seeking partial success, the Ukrainian general staff said in his daily briefing late on Thursday. Well, summary of Thursday's events in Russia's war on Ukraine. The United Nations Refugee Agency says that more than 6 million people have fled Ukraine since the Russian invasion began. A total of 2.4 million people have moved beyond Ukraine's immediate border countries. 1,000 bodies have been recovered near the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv in recent days, with many of the killings possibly amounting to war crimes amid the Russian invasion, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet. She's originally from Chile. The European Union has called on member states to urgently find ways to transport essential agricultural goods from Ukraine via land routes to stabilize global food supplies. Russia's blockade of key ports in the Black Sea has caused global food prices and shortages to hit record levels. Ukraine's prosecutor general, Irina Venediktova, said that her office has charged a 21-year-old Russian sergeant in connection with the killing of an elderly civilian who was gunned down while riding a bicycle. Finnish President Sauli Niinisto and Prime Minister Sanna Marin have said their country must apply to join the NATO military alliance as quickly as possible, a policy turnaround that had been prompted by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So those are some of the big issues, for example, that you need to hear about. One second. All right. Let me just look over here. Bear with me a second. Let me move on to, is this here? Yes, this is really very important. There are new challenges for the alliance as Finland and Sweden inch closer to membership. It seems that Finland has announced a decision to join NATO as quickly as possible. Sweden is expected to follow suit shortly. And the question is, what does this mean for the alliance? NATO's land border with Russia is set to more than double as Finland and Sweden submit their membership applications to the country's most powerful defense alliance. Russia currently shares a land border of 754 miles. With NATO members. Once Finland joins, that will increase to 2,600 kilometers. That's almost twice as much, actually more than twice as much. So we're looking at about, 1,800 miles. In a joint statement on Thursday, Finland's President Sauli Niinisto and Prime Minister Sanna Marin said their country's membership would strengthen the entire defense alliance. Finland must apply for NATO membership without delay. We hope that the national steps still needed to make this decision will be taken rapidly within the next few days. Sweden, meanwhile, which has traditionally been more reluctant to join the alliance, is expected to make an announcement this weekend. So that's going to be very, very telling as well. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Now, this is very important. In keeping with its 1939 tradition, Finland is saying no to Vladimir Putin. Finland's membership in NATO would signal the end of over 70 years of Moscow's most enduring policy. This is a humiliation for Vladimir Putin. Well, the story goes, I was a teenager when my godmother, Olga, first told me about the Winter War of 1939 to 1940 between the Soviet Union and Finland. She was a nurse in a Moscow hospital when Joseph Stalin launched his ill-prepared conquest of Finland under a spurious pretext. It was horrible, she said. All those young soldiers with terrible frostbite and untreatable wounds from sniper fire. The Finns really trounced our army, but we were not allowed to talk about it, my godmother told me. They had to give up some territory to us, but we never conquered them. And this was a shock to me. There was one paragraph about this war in our history textbooks. So growing up in the late Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s, Finland was seen as the friendliest of the capitalist countries. Finnish products like processed Viola cheese and winter jackets were the Western products a Soviet citizen could occasionally hope to buy. After Olga's story, I could not think of the Finns as harmless cheese producers anymore. Years later, I heard a famous 1939 Finnish war song with the chorus, Niet Molotov, or which in translation is No Molotov, a popular rebuke to Stalin's foreign affairs commissar Vyacheslav Molotov. The Finns indeed managed to preserve their independence, but at the expense of the so-called Finlandization, which meant adhering to certain limitations and conditions imposed by Moscow. Remaining non-aligned, simply put, not joining NATO, was the main restriction after the alliance was created in 1949. Even in 1991, when the USSR collapsed, Finnish public opinion remained lukewarm towards NATO membership. Finland has always enjoyed significant economic cooperation with Russia. It imports most of its oil and gas from its eastern neighbor. Rosatom, a Russian state nuclear power plant construction enterprise, planned to build one in Finland, a rare project for a Western country. Maintaining constant political engagement with the Kremlin was a staple of Finnish policy. As recently as January, Finland's president, Finland Sauli Niinisto, remained one of the few Western leaders who regularly talked to and met with President Vladimir Putin. But these days, a remix of that old 1939 war tune is playing in Helsinki. The Finns are saying yet again, this time to Putin, they are ready to join the North Atlantic Alliance. Finlandization, one of the most enduring features of the post-World War II European security landscape, has become obsolete in a matter of weeks in the wake of the Kremlin's assault on Ukraine. This is a massive political defeat for Putin. Ever since his first official visit to Finland in 2001, he invested a lot of effort into cultivating the country's politicians and businesses, only to see this policy collapse within the space of a few weeks. Symbolically, Finland recently canceled Rosatom's nuclear power plant project. Moscow is now reportedly threatening to cut its energy delivery to Finland imminently, but the Finns are ready for temporary hardship as they reorient towards other suppliers. Their long experience with the Russians has taught them that the Kremlin only takes those seriously who are prepared to make sacrifices and stand their ground. Well, Putin's policy has backfired. Putin's military blackmail has not fared any better. The war against Ukraine has revealed the pitiful state of the Russian army. At the same time, Finnish armed forces regularly train with NATO, possess advanced weaponry, and are fully interoperable with the alliance's armies. If the Kremlin increases its military presence along the more than 1,000 kilometers of 621-mile border with Finland, the Finns can expect their new allies, including the United States, to bolster their defense by deploying to the area. And Russia's strategic position in the region will become much worse. With Sweden likely to follow Finland, the Baltic Sea will effectively become NATO's backyard. The Kaliningrad region, the Russian enclave surrounded by Poland and Lithuania, would be even easier to isolate should the alliance wish to do so. The historical irony is inescapable. Putin made opposing NATO enlargement his signature policy, only to end up with NATO forces stationed some 130 kilometers from St. Petersburg. Molotov would have definitely disapproved. So that's where we stand. Unbelievable. Then, just in case you haven't heard, but I would think that you have, North Korea's COVID admission reveals a serious health situation. After more than 2 years of denying the virus had gained a foothold, Pyongyang is now struggling to handle thousands of suspected cases with limited medical capabilities. More than 2 years after the coronavirus pandemic began to spread across the world, North Korea confirmed on Thursday the first case of the illness within its borders. By Friday morning, the government in Pyongyang had admitted six deaths, was treating 18,000 people with fevers, and had placed nearly 190,000 more in isolation. Stark admission that the authorities are struggling to contain the problem is a remarkable about-face for a country that has previously boasted that its policy of sealing the borders in the early months of the pandemic had been successful in keeping the virus at bay. Few virologists believe the claim or believed the claim at the time, but international health and aid organizations were initially restricted to Pyongyang before eventually being ordered to leave the country. Dissident media have periodically reported claims that an unidentified illness was running rampant through a society with extremely limited public health capabilities and that the victims were being buried before a cause of death could be confirmed. But the regime of Kim Jong-un continued to insist that nothing was amiss. Pyongyang even went as far as turning down an offer from UNICEF in September of last year of 3 million doses of the Sinovac vaccine on the ground that it was handling the situation in, quote, our style, end quote. On Thursday, Kim ordered a nationwide lockdown, state media releasing images of the dictator chairing a meeting of his Politburo in a mask. The government has described the situation as a most critical emergency for the nation of 26 million people, with residents of the capital ordered to return to their homes on Thursday and remain inside. The imposition of a lockdown for an unspecified national problem, the public was told, has led to reports of panic buying and shortages of some staples. For Pyongyang to publicly admit Omicron cases, the public health situation must be serious, said Leif Erik Easley, an associate professor of international studies at UHA, a women's university in Seoul. Pyongyang will likely double down on lockdowns, even though the failure of China's zero COVID strategy suggests that approach won't work against the Omicron variant. And North Korea is entering a period of uncertainty in managing its domestic challenges and international isolation. Kim regime would be well advised to swallow its pride and quickly seek donations of vaccines and therapeutics. The office of the South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, confirmed late on Thursday that it was ready to provide humanitarian assistance to its neighbor, with Seoul apparently considering medical assistance to be an exception to the broad sanctions that have been imposed on the North for its nuclear and long-range missile programs. Should the offer be accepted, aid might act as a breakthrough in the chilly relations on the peninsula, although that likelihood appears to be slim. China has similarly said it is ready to fully support its ally. In a press briefing at the White House on Thursday, spokeswoman Jen Psaki said that the U.S. would support international efforts to help vaccinate the people of North Korea, but pointedly accused Pyongyang of harming its own citizens by denying them access to international aid by instead opting to spend its limited financial resources on nuclear weapons. Despite the offers of assistance, Pyongyang appears to be set on a path of confrontation and provocation despite the worsening health crisis. When three short-range ballistic missiles were fired into the Sea of Japan late on Thursday evening, with analysts suggesting the launches had the twin aim of distracting domestic attention away from the nation's health crisis and simultaneously sending a warning to Yoon that the conservative prime minister who was sworn in on Tuesday. It is difficult to know what is happening in the North because it is such a closed society and we cannot trust what they say, but my belief is that there will be a lot of cases of the coronavirus there, said Park Yong-won, a professor of politics and international relations at South Korea's Dankook University. And while other countries have seen instances of social unrest as a result of restrictions imposed in an effort to combat the spread of the virus, Park said that protests against the government's handling of the crisis are unlikely. They will be able to use this as a form of political propaganda to let the world know that the situation is under control and that the people are complying with the government's orders. It is also possible that the North is giving very mixed messages ahead of U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to South Korea next week, Park had added, and attempting to sow further confusion about Pyongyang's intentions and priorities at a time when Seoul and Washington are attempting to focus on the North's weapons program and the possibility of a new underground nuclear test in the coming weeks. So those are some of the issues that are there, but I'm glad that President is going to go to South Korea and just deal with it, which is really terrific. Okay, now let's look at some other things that are very, very important. One second here. So the question now is, what caused the latest crypto crash? It seems that cryptocurrency investors fled from the risky asset after one of the most trusted coins, Terra, T-E-R-R-A, took a nosedive. Prolonged dip could destabilize emerging markets like El Salvador. Some cryptocurrency billionaires have lost over half their wealth over the last weeks as skittish investors pulled their cash out of the notoriously risky asset. A sell-off wiped out more than $200 billion from the cryptocurrency market in 24 hours alone as of Thursday, according to price-tracking website CoinMarketCap, but the wealthy aren't the only ones at risk. The latest slump was driven in large by peculiar behavior from so-called stable coins. Stable coins are meant to hold a strong peg to an external asset like gold or the U.S. dollar. And this makes them less price volatile than other cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin, the world's most popular cryptocurrency known for its big risk and big rewards. Backing by an external asset or an algorithm that controls the coin supply keeps a stable coin's price, well, stable, until it doesn't, that is. The promise behind Terra USD, also known as UST, the world's third largest stable coin, was that it would always maintain parity with the U.S. dollar. At the time of publication, the coin's value has completely collapsed, and this happened after massive withdrawals from Terra ignited fears that the coin would crash, causing even more traders to pull out. The world's largest stable coin, Tether, also briefly became unpegged, its price falling to less than one U.S. dollar. So some of the crypto space are speculating that it was an orchestrated attack to undermine the reputation of stable coins but cryptocurrencies are also grappling with the changing conditions of the global economy. We're in times of higher uncertainty, Ulrich, the head of foreign exchange at Commerzbank, had said, it's a German bank. You could see that in the weak stock market, and you see that in all the other assets, which are also volatile right now. So cryptocurrencies are now extremely volatile and suffering because of that. Now, people in the crypto market are used to big swings, but the unusual economic environment we're now in is unnerving even traditional investors. Major stock indices in the United States saw a sell-off last week after the U.S. Federal Reserve raised interest rates, part of its plan to combat spiking consumer prices. In many countries, years of ultra-low interest rates coupled with the government stimulus unleashed during the pandemic sent streams of cash flowing into riskier investments like stock, like tech stocks and crypto. Now those initiatives are winding down, and the potential for inflation to weigh on economic growth has many seeking safer investments than they've done in the past. The notion of decentralized cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin serving as an inflation hedge, has been clearly refuted by the sharp fall in their prices in the face of inflation surges around the world. Eswar Prasad, the professor of economics at Cornell University in the United States, said. Now, Bitcoin has also fallen below and with the ever-important $30,000 mark, nearly hitting $25,000 on Thursday, a price that hasn't seen in 16 months. Over that time period, the world watched as electric car maker Tesla added $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin to its balance sheet, and the countries of El Salvador and the Central African Republic made the cryptocurrency into a form of legal tender. Companies like Starbucks and PayPal began accepting it as payment. Now, these moves helped legitimize Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency market as a whole, which saw major gains over the course of the pandemic. Cryptocurrency hit a high of 68,000 in November of 2021. The explosion in the crypto world this week and the gradual decline leading up to it now have many talking about a potential crypto winter setting in. According to the Financial Times, the global digital assets market has lost half of its value since its peak in November of last year. So this is particularly concerning for emerging markets like El Salvador that have invested heavily in cryptocurrency. According to Bloomberg, the country, which has invested at least $105 million in Bitcoin since last September, has lost around $40 million since March. That's more than El Salvador owes for its next foreign bond payment due in June. Embracing a speculative financial asset as the national legal tender is an act of folly that could have grave consequences for developing economies and their citizens, some of which are already becoming apparent, Prasad had said. A 2021 report from the Bank of America showed that after the United States, emerging markets led the way in the trading, mining, and spending of cryptocurrencies. Leaders included China, Colombia, India, Kazakhstan, Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, Ukraine, and Vietnam. In January, the International Monetary Fund warned that the volatility of cryptocurrencies was having a destabilizing effect on the flow of capital in the emerging markets, and that using it in place of traditional currencies posed, quote, immediate and acute risks, the Financial Times reported. It's still unclear whether this is a bursting of the crypto bubble, long predicted by skeptics. Terra USD's founder is scrambling for external financing to restore the coin's dollar parity, while Tether, the main stablecoin used to buy Bitcoin, regained its one-to-one peg. Its management seemed largely unfazed by the crisis. With cryptocurrencies, there is still the danger that cryptocurrencies as a whole suddenly become an asset class that no one is interested in anymore, said Leuchtmann, and therefore we always have the danger that we will see a massive crash in one or the other cryptocurrency because speculative investors no longer come back. What is clear is that the wobbly state of the global economy has made a crypto crash feel more plausible, also for regulators. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen made a push this week for the regulation of digital assets. Stablecoin regulation by the end of 2022 would be highly appropriate, she said, considering the many risks associated with cryptocurrencies. So, these are like major issues, that's for sure. Bear with me a second as we move forward. One second. Well, thousands of Palestinians are going to gather or are already gathered for a slain journalist's Jerusalem funeral amid tensions. Team security forces and members of the public clashed repeatedly as pallbearers carried the journalist's coffin. Veteran reporter Shireen Abu Akhle was shot in the head while covering an Israeli military operation. Thousands of Palestinian mourners gathered on Friday for the funeral and burial of veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akhle, who was killed on Wednesday while covering an Israeli military operation in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. A Catholic funeral service was held for Abu Akhle in Jerusalem's Old City, and her body was then taken to a nearby cemetery for burial. Al Jazeera Managing Director Ahmad Al-Yafei was scheduled to attend the service, as did large crowds of Palestinian mourners. A large Israeli police presence was on hand, with tensions running high. Security forces and members of the public clashed repeatedly as pallbearers carried the journalist's coffin. Police had shown up at previous events mourning Abu Akhle's killing, at which they removed Palestinian flags. Well, both Al Jazeera and the Palestinian Authority, the PA, have blamed Israel for the journalist's death, saying that soldiers shot her deliberately. Israel has voiced its desire to conduct a joint investigation into the incident alongside the Palestinian Authority, saying the only way to determine who killed Abu Akhle would be to conduct a forensic examination of the projectile. The Palestinian Authority has refused the request, saying it will conduct its own investigation and signaling its intention to take the case to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, in The Hague. Israel's military says it has conducted a preliminary investigation into the incident nevertheless, but said its results remain inconclusive. Israel claims Palestinian militants are firing heavy artillery at Israeli soldiers near the spot from which Abu Akhle was reporting and says it is unclear whether she was fatally hit by those militants or Israeli soldiers firing a returning fire. Reporters who were with Abu Akhle when she was shot say there were no firefights in the area. All of the journalists present, one of whom was also shot and wounded, were wearing clearly marked protective gear identifying them as the press. A respected member of the local press corps, Shireen Abu Akhle, a 51-year-old TV journalist, began work at the Qatar-based Al Jazeera in 1997 and attained renown for her coverage of the so-called Second Intifada against Israeli rule in the early 2000s. Tensions have been high in and around Jenin in recent weeks, with militants carrying out a number of deadly attacks in Israel. These have triggered near daily raids and arrests by Israeli authorities, some of which have in turn led to firefights. Israeli forces entered the city again on Friday morning, with heavy gunfire and explosions reported. The Palestinian health minister reported that 11 Palestinians had been hospitalized with injuries. The Israeli military says it came under fire when it sought to arrest militants. And Prime Minister Naftali Bennett later said that an Israeli soldier was killed in the operation. So now let's just quickly look at a couple of other issues that you might find interesting. Bear with me a moment. Well, let's see what's going on in Lebanon. Evidently, voters are clinging to the hopes that the election can deliver a change. Lebanon elects a new parliament on May 15th. Even though many people harbor hope for change, it won't be a walk in the park for the opposition. Lebanon's adult population will elect a new parliament on May 15th, the first parliamentary election since the Beirut port blast. And the devastating explosion destroyed whole neighborhoods and killed hundreds of people on August 4 of 2020. This election is extremely important to us, said Amal Nazaruddin. The 38-year-old doctor admits that until now, she has always cast a blank ballot. It was clear each time the corrupt political elite would win again, she said. This time, however, she's harboring real hope. Nazaruddin and her family live 20 minutes south of Lebanon's capital of Beirut. Although she holds both an American and a Lebanese passport, there is no talk of her leaving her home country. Yet at the same time, she would love to live in a country where it is possible to buy food, receive medical assistance, and tank up on gas. In her eyes, the established political classes and their supporters have been exploiting the country for decades. As a consequence, the country is on the verge of an economic breakdown, and propping it up has virtually become mission impossible. Baha Dalal is more than willing to step up to the challenge. I'm running for election because I feel it's my duty and it is an ethical necessity to do, he explained. He's fully aware of the scope ahead. Social, economic, educational, and health-related problems have been addressed, as well as the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. For the upcoming parliamentary election, Dalal has joined the opposition list of the Eastern Constituency of Rashaya and West Bekaa, along with other independent campaigners. Now, back in 2019, when people took to the streets on October 17, Dalal was one of those protesting against the government. I am now running for election to continue the journey of the October 17 revolution, he said, adding that his purpose is to defend people's rights and help put an end to their suffering, to achieve social justice and human dignity, which have become lost in our country. As well as being a full-time teacher, Baha Dalal has been campaigning for months. He's convinced that the Lebanese population not only needs change, but is also ready for it. Few question that the current crisis and the Lebanese political elite's dismal record are down to mismanagement and corruption. As a result, the country is stuck in a devastating economic loop. The currency is depreciated by 90%, producing hyperinflation and dire shortages of fuel, medicine, and other essential goods. Electricity is almost non-existent, with the country's mobile networks and internet in danger of imminent collapse. Furthermore, the war in Ukraine is threatening to worsen the hunger crisis. Since Lebanon used to import up to 80% of wheat from Ukraine and Russia, the government isn't keeping pace with their obligations, says Anna Fleischer, the head of the Heinrich Böll Foundation's office in Beirut. Currently, not even passports can be issued anymore. The reason? A lack of new blank documents. Meanwhile, those in power have been trying hard to protect those responsible for the port blast. The explosion in August 2020 was one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in human history. But then, Lebanon has long been known for its culture of impunity. National and international election observers long thought this year's parliamentary election would be canceled. Before the last election in 2018, the parliament had effectively postponed elections for years. The fact that the elections are nevertheless taking place is significant and can be considered a litmus test for Lebanon's democratic processes. A total of 128 parliamentary seats are up for grabs. All of the traditional parties are running with their familiar leaders, including the Free Patriotic Movement, Amal, Hezbollah, the Lebanese Forces, and the Progressive Socialist Party of the Druze. Prime Minister Saad Hariri, however, is no longer on the list. Once the leading face of the Sunnis in Lebanon, retiree Hariri has plunged his faith community into chaos. Even if some candidates run on behalf of the Sunnis, Hariri's retirement will inevitably lead to new alliances. 1943, Lebanon has adhered to a system of power distribution that seeks to represent the various religious factions of the country. Back then, the sectarian forces or groups agreed to divide state offices and parliamentary seats according to a system of religious proportional representation, namely the prime minister had to be a Sunni, the president a Christian, and the speaker of parliament a Shiite Muslim. Well, the European Union observes the election. For the first time, Sunday's election is set to reveal the country, the population's true level of support for new factions and candidates who do not herald from the traditional parties. Following the uprising in 2019, new names emerged on the political landscape like Hat Ahmar, which is Red Line, People's Anti-Corruption Observatory, Shamaluna, which means Our North, as well as Sahlona Wal Jabal, or Lowlands and Mountains, the independent list to which candidate Baha Dalal belongs. It is important to break the circle of politicians who inherit their power and seats from their ancestors and to work towards a civilized country without discrimination and sectarianism, Dalal had said. Ammar Aboud, an election expert and founder of the Lebanese Association for Democratic Election, believes this is the only way forward to introduce change. It is also a chance to show how much support the ruling parties have forfeited. Despite this, Aboud knows there is still room for manipulation. He's convinced the recent series of crises has made it easier to buy votes. The coffers of traditional parties are full, and some of them expect support from abroad. Only recently, Saudi Arabia's ambassador returned to Beirut after months of tension, and some see his return as sending a message to Hezbollah, which is supported by Saudi Arabia's arch-enemy, Iran. In my opinion, the return of the Saudi ambassador signaled that Saudi Arabia isn't completely withdrawing from Lebanon, Faisha said. It is no secret that Saudi Arabia is set to support Lebanon financially as well. While Lebanon does not have an election monitoring commission, it suffers from chronic underfunding, like many other institutions in the country. The European Union is therefore sending its own team of election observers to Lebanon, as it did in 2018. Josep Borrell, the European Union's foreign affairs representative, stated that the European Union is also providing financial and technical assistance in the run-up to the elections. The aim is to strengthen democratic development and reform in Lebanon. So the mission is headed by the Hungarian Christian Democratic Democrat Gyorgy Hovenyi, a member of the European Union's Department of Human Rights. So there's a little prospect of a structural change. In contrast to the colorful posters and billboards of the country, the Lebanese people are far from optimistic about the election. The majority are tired, exhausted by everyday life and the crisis. Things haven't become any easier since 2018. Following the October 2019 protests, the opposition split into many different groups. They didn't manage to form joint lists, as Anna Fleischer of the Beul Foundation. The likelihood of actual structural change is very low. And despite this, people are hoping that as many oppositional candidates as possible will be able to gain a seat in parliament. There are many hidden votes for the opposition from people who openly declare affiliation with the present regime, and there are many previous non-voters who are going to vote this year, Amal Nazaruddin explained. So the Lebanese Diaspora Network and the Lebanese Ministry of Interior confirmed this assessment. Some 244,000 Lebanese abroad have registered for the election. In total, 4 million people are eligible to vote. So that's the story. And what she wants is one good thing to lead to another. If people see hope in these elections, then maybe the rest will begin to change slowly too. We just have to be patient. That's what Amal Nazaruddin says. She remains optimistic despite knowing that difficult times lie ahead and nothing is impossible, she says. Well, that's our time with you today. That's the weekend for us as well. And it's before us. So we wish you well. We thank you for being with us. Again, thanks Assembly Member Nita Sayers for joining us in the first opening hour. And we wish you all the best, and let's hope for a peaceful transition And who knows, maybe the Germans will be able to do something, Olaf Scholz and Putin, and Putin will relent. He's turning out to be a criminal on the world stage. Take care and goodbye.